Hello and welcome to the IEA School of Thought series with me, Sai Kamal. School of Thought is our weekly show on classical liberal thought, looking at different strands of thought within classical liberalism, discussing leading classical liberal thinkers, and applying some of these ideas to current issues. Now, this show is inspired by the IEA book, School of Thought, 100 Great Liberal Thinkers, by Eamon Butler, which, as the title suggests, summarises the thoughts of leading classical liberal thinkers on issues such as politics, government, social institutions, capitalism, rights, liberty, and morality. Now, we'll consider a number of questions and issues, including the relevance of their thoughts to some of the issues facing us today. But before we get started, please do check out our online content at the IEA YouTube channel, which is IEA London. And don't forget to subscribe to our new IEA Daily Bulletin to make sure that you don't miss out on any of our fascinating and thought-provoking online content. In addition, you can see more at www.iea.org.uk. Now, today's featured thinker is Ibn Khaldun. And to discuss his life and work, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Benedict Kohler, who is a historian and former banker, and the author of Early Islam and the Birth of Capitalism. Benedict, welcome, and thank you for joining me today.
Well, nice to see you, Siad.
Now, you've chosen Ibn Khaldun to discuss with me today. When you think about the words economics and liberalism, you think about them very much as products of the modern world. What makes you describe or think of Ibn Khaldun in these terms?
Well, that is a hurdle for us, isn't it? Ibn Khaldun, just to give a few facts about his CV, just to explain why it's so hard for us to picture him as a liberal and an economist, he lived in the 14th century. That is not an era when you think of people thinking about liberalism and economics. But I think Ibn Khaldun did exactly that. The way to point this out is to contrast him with somebody who was almost an exact contemporary in terms of date of birth and year of death, Geoffrey Chaucer. Chaucer and Ibn Khaldun had a lot in common. They were government officials. They were highly educated. They wrote books that are still being read today. But there's a big difference between Chaucer's life and Ibn Khaldun's life. Chaucer spent his life in England, and his contribution was there to kickstart English literature. Ibn Khaldun came from a family that had lived in Spain for a long time, and he moved from there to Morocco, to Tunisia, and then to Egypt. So he was very cosmopolitan. But on top of that, he came from a tradition of writing and thinking about history and economics that had already been in place for about 700 years. So unlike Chaucer, who was in a country that was starting up its literary tradition, Ibn Khaldun lived in a cosmopolitan, multicultural world that already had centuries of literary and scholarship tradition behind. Now, what makes him liberal with all that is that he was somebody who thought about the position of the individual and how individuals are constrained by society and by government, and how sometimes that leads to tensions that make societies move backwards and sometimes move forwards. So he was in the tradition of the Enlightenment. He looked at the world around him and made up his own mind and made some recommendations. And that, to me, makes him a liberal and an economist.
Now, you've mentioned it, you know, about the time of the Enlightenment and also the time that he was alive. What is it about him that makes him stand out for you? And more particularly, what makes him stand out for readers today?
Well, the biggest book that you can get penned by Ibn Khaldun, available in English, not all of his books are, by the way, is the Muqaddima. Now, that means preface. You wouldn't be able to tell if you looked at the book because it runs to hundreds of pages, but it is the preface to a very much longer bit about the history of countries and cultures neighboring Egypt, the Berbers. Now, what makes him interesting to anybody who's interested in history and how people write about history is looking at how Ibn Khaldun approached history and compare him to what historians had been doing up until then. Look at the great Roman historians, Livius or Tacitus or Sallustus. One thing they have in common is they write about Romans and nobody else. If you then look at the Middle Ages, you look at someone like Augustine, who wrote The City of God. What did he do? He started thinking about the direction of history overall. That is not a thought that ever crossed the mind of the classical Roman historians. Now, Ibn Khaldun took history writing to another new level. He started thinking about patterns in history of cycles and trends of societies going up or going down. And he thought about how economics has something to do with that. Now, you won't find a lot of economics in any of the Roman authors or in Augustine, but you do find that in Ibn Khaldun. And that makes him someone who marks a new phase in the way we think about history. So that makes him a standout historian.
And did he have a profound impact on you specifically, or was it because you admire the role that he played in shaping our thinking?
I liked reading Ibn Khaldun because he came at the end of a very long tradition of writing about history and economics that had started up in Islam many, many centuries earlier, at a time when the contemporaries of these earlier economists had no corresponding thinkers in the world of Christendom or anywhere else. So he came from a very rich culture. But there's a lot more to learn about Ibn Khaldun simply because so many of his works even now are not translated into English. Practically all of his work has been translated into one of the modern languages, French, German, Italian, English. But there is no modern language where you can read all of Ibn Khaldun. So he's a rich source of reflection and always fun to read again.
Now, over time, you've heard in recent years some politicians, I mean, for example, I think about 20, 30 years ago, Ronald Reagan quoted Ibn Khaldun. More recently, the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has quoted Ibn Khaldun. But when you think about him in terms of a sort of classical liberal narrative and political thought as a whole, how influential do you think he is? And also, not only now, but what about going back? Was he someone who struggled to get his ideas heard at the time, only to be vindicated later? Or did he have an immediate impact?
Well, in Europe, we needed to catch up, and we were on a steep learning curve regarding the tradition of Arabic literature for many, many centuries. Ibn Khaldun was first translated into a modern language, into French, just before the year 1700. And back then, people weren't all that attuned to thinking about patterns in history or attuned to thinking about sociology. And interest in Ibn Khaldun really began to take off in the 20th century, when historians and sociologists and social scientists and economists came to the fore. And the kind of person who was outside the field of Arabic or Islamic scholarship, who would start saying, Ibn Khaldun is really interesting, would be someone who looked at big picture history writing, someone like Arnold Toynbee, who praised Ibn Khaldun. And you've already mentioned Ronald Reagan before, but one of the ideas men, one of the thinking people in the Reagan era was the economist Arthur Laffer. And Arthur Laffer was somebody who said that as far as taxation economics is concerned, Ibn Khaldun was way ahead of his time. And Laffer said, a lot of what I say has already been spelled out by Ibn Khaldun a good long time ago. So it's now that we're more interested in sociology that Ibn Khaldun has become of greater relevance.
Now, you say it took Europe a bit of time to catch up with some of the Arabic literature, but what about the world that Ibn Khaldun lived in? Did he have an impact in his immediate world then?
Well, he was conversant with economics and business economics, and that is something that is germane to Islam and was germane to Islam from the very beginning of Islam and before. Just keep in mind that where Arabs lived, when they looked out the window, they knew it wasn't going to be a very promising prospect to make a living out of agriculture. So they had to think of something. They had to get on their bike. And they did that by really kickstarting globalization. Long before Mohammed was born, Arabs were already sending caravans that went from India to Europe. And they were traders and intermediaries. So they already had a sense, they already had it in their cultural DNA to be entrepreneurial and to be long distance traders. And one of the ways you can tell that this DNA traveled to Europe is that we have a good word to describe what an entrepreneur does. He takes a risk. A risk is something that you'd love to be able to calculate, but you can't really. Sometimes things go well, sometimes they don't. And the word risk, it's not a Roman word, although it sounds kind of Latin. It's actually Arabic. And Muhammad himself was familiar with the word, and in the Quran you'll find it in many, many connotations where it has many, many different shades of meaning. But Muhammad himself was a merchant, and being a merchant was a high class, a high prestige profession in the Islamic world. That was, after all, the backbone of the Arabic economy. And so for many centuries, people would write about business economics. I'll just mention one or two names. Abu Yusuf, in the Abbasid era, he wrote about taxation, about the incentive to pay taxes, and what governments can do to improve tax morale. Or I'll mention another one, al-Dimashqi, who wrote one of, and it wasn't the only one who did, but one of the many business manuals on how to get ahead in business, whose name, as you can guess from al-Dimashqi, means he was someone who came from Damascus. So by the time Ibn Khaldun came along in the 1300s, remember, to us that sounds like a very recent era of cultural development. If you were Ibn Khaldun, if you were a highly educated, cosmopolitan, Muslim official, that you already had centuries and centuries of economic thinking behind you. I remember Ibn Khaldun also had a student by the name of Makritzi, who also had some one or two things to say about taxes, especially about the way taxes tend to be going up and up and up and never into any other direction. And he said, we have so many different taxes imposed on us in Egypt. The only thing we can do without being taxed is breathe. So they were very sophisticated in the way they looked at economics. And you can see that in Ibn Khaldun's work as well. It's woven into the way he describes societies and how societies practice and wane.
So on that, could you say a little bit about what Ibn Khaldun actually has to say about economics?
Well, it would take... Siad, I suspect that would make more than one session, but let me just limit myself to mentioning two ideas. Many of his ideas are well known about division of labor and about price differentials in different cities. You'll find that in other economic work of the time as well. But there are one or two, and the first one was his thinking about taxation, where he pointed out that when a new dynasty comes to office, governments don't really feel they need to impose many taxes, and governments do very well as far as tax morale is concerned for that very reason, because taxes are very low. But as times go on, governments get used to being in government, and they think of other things that it would be nice to spend money on, and they spend more and more, and they tax more and more. And this goes on for a while and sounds very good and nobody minds, but eventually you reach a tipping point. That's not the word Ibn Khaldun uses, but that's what he means, that taxes go up to a point where people who work say, there's really not much in it for me any longer. And they say, why should I keep on working if most of the profit that I make goes to the government? So, overall, the government discovers that tax take overall starts going down. So you need to find a tax rate that is as low as possible, because it will increase the volume of taxes paid overall. And that's the idea of Ibn Khaldun that caught the eye of Arthur Laffer. And Arthur Laffer's idea caught the eye of Ronald Reagan. So he was a great tax economist. I think that's underestimated in our writing about Islamic economics of the Middle Ages. We don't quite appreciate that they were very sophisticated in their take on tax. And there's a second idea, I said, and that's about market regulation. And this is an aspect of Ibn Khaldun's writing which I feel still has a long way to go to be fully appreciated. The reason I say that, Siad, is because market regulation is a field in economics that's comparatively new. It's really only from Coasean economics and Chicago School economics onward that we've started thinking about the interaction of market actors on the one hand and the framework of markets on the other. And Ibn Khaldun writes a lot about market structure and market institutions. And he has extensive comments about the office of the Mutazib, that's the market regulator. And the Mutazib, the market regulator, is someone who is authorized to ban someone from the market if he's not competing fairly. He is someone to whom a customer can appeal if he feels he's been shortchanged. A Mutazib in the Middle Ages in an Islamic city also had a lot to do with building regulations. If he could tell you to take down your building, if he thought it was a threat to people passing by, he could also tell you to clear the roads if you had if your shop was blocking people coming and going to the marketplace. So the Mutazib was a very important office, and in Ibn Khaldun, and this is my point, he stresses the importance of the Mutazib for maintaining and creating trust in market activity, and he said the Mutazib should be appointed by the highest authority, by the caliph, and that market regulation and fairness in markets and integrity of market participants and supervision of that integrity was, in the last analysis, a religious duty. This takes me into, would launch us into another sphere of Islamic economics, but it's right there, woven into the DNA of Islam, to see that connection between economics, ethics, and entrepreneurship. So those are the two things that I see are standout: tax ideas and market regulation.
So you speak about taxation and market regulation. Are there any other particular insights from Ibn Khaldun that are relevant today?
Well, the other insights, Siad, I'd mentioned that he was always clear about price fluctuations. I think we, in conversation, mentioned once or twice, there is that the notion that in Occidental, in Western medieval thinking, there was the idea that prices ought to be regulated, that there was such a thing as the fair price, and governments were there to enforce that fair price. Ibn Khaldun never thought that. He thought prices depend on the here and now and the where. So he would write about prices differing from one city to another. And he would not, and this is what makes him an economist, he'd not only describe prices being high or low in different places, he'd also explain the reason. He'd say a lot of that has to do with the means of transport. Is it easy to get from one city to another? Which, by implication, tells you that he thought that governments had to make sure that transport was easy, feasible, and probably, I suspect, looking at the Middle East, safe. So that was another of his ideas. There were other aspects, I see, one could mention. He thought about division of labor. He thought about why some societies prosper and others don't. There were also one or two other ideas which have recurred again and again in sociological writing about the clash between cultures that are sedentary and urban and cultures which are nomadic and which don't depend on high incomes. And he said, again and again, you see societies, I think Huntington would call it, I might be using this term in the wrong context now, but Ibn Khaldun would call it a clash of civilizations. And he said cultures, especially when they become urban and have high wealth, they tend to lose their self-confidence or their will to resist or their will to overcome adversity. So there are many philosophical ideas there as well that it would be worthwhile immersing oneself in, and which are philosophical, historiographical, but take you beyond the sphere of economics proper.
Do we know much about Ibn Khaldun as a person, about his life, his family life, for example, other issues?
Well, what's so interesting is when you look at Ibn Khaldun, and you know he came from a prominent family, you know he had his ups and downs in life. He was a judge. In Egypt, he was a judge. He was a judge in Egypt, and he was fired because he didn't hand down the decisions that the government wanted him to. But they hired him back again. Now, Ibn Khaldun is very interesting. I didn't mention that earlier, so thank you for raising this point, because he wrote an autobiography. Now, these days, that's not a rare thing to be doing, but in the 14th century, that is very rare indeed. And if you look at the literature that's come down from classical Greece, classical Rome, from the Middle Ages, how many autobiographies can you think of? You might think of the one by Augustine. Yeah. And after Augustine, how many people wrote autobiographies? There were centuries of silence. But here in the 1300s, there's this guy. He says, I'm going to write down everything that I've done in my life. That shows a new appreciation of individualism that wasn't, that was cutting edge, that was a new voice to think of oneself as something, as a topic worth describing. But he had a very, very tough life. I mentioned that he moved from place to place, not always because he wanted to. He fell out of favor with some governments. His family, he moved from Tunisia to Egypt, and he suffered personal tragedy too. His family was on the way to follow him, and they were shipwrecked, and he never saw them again. So he had many success stories to show in his life, but he also had lots of things that must have troubled him greatly and were very sad. But he was always out there and trying to learn new things. You may be aware of Tamerlane, the far eastern conqueror of Baghdad. And when he invaded the Mesopotamia, well, Ibn Khaldun said, I'd really like to meet this man. And he went out there, and Tamerlane, to his credit, said, well, I've got no problem with that. Let's have a talk. And they met. And that talk has also been recorded by Ibn Khaldun and has been handed down to posterity. I don't know how many other people interviewed Tamerlane. I certainly wouldn't have wanted to interview Tamerlane. But it tells you what a kind of a person Ibn Khaldun was.
He's certainly intellectually curious. When you think about some of the lessons, if I asked you to pick out some of the lessons that classical liberals can learn from him, what would you say? And also, what would you wish that we understood better now? And maybe finally, on top of that, you know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Are there particular lessons that would be relevant for the pandemic, or just generally for the 21st century?
What surprised me immensely in reading Ibn Khaldun and reading other economists, Arab and non-Arab Islamic economists of the Middle Ages, is how comparatively little of their work is actually available in modern languages. I mean, if you think of Ibn Khaldun, he's the most famous, he's the poster boy of medieval Arab historiography. When you think that it took until 1958 for Muqaddimah to be translated into English. You see, we're really not that far along on our learning curve. And as I mentioned early on, Muqaddimah means preface. The bit that comes after the preface isn't available in English. Unless you read French or Arabic, you won't be able to engage with it. So there's still a long way to go just from the very essential bit of giving everybody the toolkit, just letting everybody read medieval Arabic literature. I could give you many other examples, but I'll just leave it at that. But what can liberals learn now? What you can learn from Ibn Khaldun is that he was cosmopolitan, that he was completely unbiased because he looked at different cultures, tried to understand them on their own terms, but he did something that sociologists do. He looked for patterns. He looked at, well, this is how it worked at one stage of Arabic history. This is how something worked at another stage of the history of the Berbers. Incidentally, he also wrote a bit about Christendom. He said the Pope was, he tried to explain it. I think this shows just how open-minded he was, that he was trying to get his point across. He said, you can compare the Pope to a kind of European caliph because he's responsible for religious issues, but he also has a lot of political power. So when you think back, that was an unbiased way trying to get a point across so that people understand them and can relate. So I think there's much that you can get out of Ibn Khaldun, and that makes for good reading.
It shows how incredibly open-minded he was, which probably helped the fact that he was curious. It's interesting because, you know, we think about Ibn Khaldun, we think about Islamic history, probably the golden age of Islam, and we think about the Arab world. We look at the Arab world today, and we look at the Islamic world today. Does he have much traction today with many Arab thinkers or leading commentators in both the Arab world and the wider Islamic world?
I would expect so. I don't travel in the Arabic and Islamic world regularly. I know he is venerated, Siad, but whether he has the fate of many classics, that once you get that the label of classic, and maybe your the death knell for your reputation is that you're taught in school, then nobody that makes sure nobody's going to read you. I'm not in a position to know that, but I am aware that he features in monuments. You'll find his monument all over in many Arabic cities. I know that he's venerated as part of the canon of Arabic literature. I'm sure that what's appreciated especially is that he's a pan-Arabic, pan-Islamic figure, simply because he moved so many times and managed to integrate and make a contribution in so many different cultures. But I think there's still a long way to go, especially as regards appreciation of his work, that where I just think on the economist side, we're very good at abstraction, at modeling, we're very good at relating to the latest publications, but I think we could do even better if we went back to someone like Ibn Khaldun and had a look at what does he actually say about market regulation, and what's in there about market regulation that maybe we could apply today. And I would have thought that's especially true in the culture where he came from.
Well, I think that's a wonderful place to end our conversation there. Benedict, that has been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for discussing Ibn Khaldun. As I said, he's one of the classical liberal thinkers that we've been looking at. You can read more about 101 Classical Liberal Thinkers, a school of thought book by the IEA, by Eamon Butler on the IEA website. For more information on our publications, our webinars and other online content, please visit www.iea.org.uk, check out our YouTube channel, IEA London, and subscribe to our IEA Daily Bulletin so you can stay updated on all our activity. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Siad. Bye for now.